Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. Oh man, according to the green bars, you guys sure can hear that bulldozer next door, huh? Negative 51? Oh no. You know what? I don't care. You know why? Because that house is a wreck. And they're finally getting it together, man. They're taking a bulldozer and they're cutting the top off of the yard. They're going to, you know, they're grading it completely, going to re-dirt it and re-sod it. And there's finally going to be a nice front yard in the yard next door. So, and you know what? They've been at it all morning and it's a tiny little yard. So, they should be done soon. Maybe they'll be done by the time our guest shows up today. It's Sheldon Richmond's going to be on the show. Well, that man, he's about as libertarian as hell. And he's going to be on to talk about, well, you know, things. Should I spoil it for you? Did I already spoil it yesterday and tell you? Yeah, I already told you yesterday what I wanted to talk to him about. Libertarian class war theory. Because, you know, it ain't only commies that have a theory of class war. Libertarians do too. Only ours is different and better. And, yeah, well, you know. Sheldon Richmond, he gets the work done, man. No doubt about that. So he's going to be on to explain, you know, how it is that the world works for you. I think you'll like it. Also, news, bad news. I can't seem to get a hold of Andrew Coburn. Sure would like to interview him about this Ukraine piece. We're going to see him out there. And we're going to talk a bit about the Iran nuclear deal. Sorry if I'm boring you to death with all the Iran nuclear deal coverage here, but that's kind of my role, man, is to cover the Iran nuclear deal. And yes, I know, I'm in an odd position of supporting a government program of this nuclear deal. But, well, I'll just explain when I get to it. And then, yeah, also there's tons of other news. I guess, today I gotta talk about, the big breaking news. I don't know if you guys saw this pretty horrible footage or, you know, must have heard the story by now. Local TV news reporters this morning in Virginia, they were interviewing some lady at a strip mall about, you know, her new store opening up or whatever kind of local news piece. And a guy walked up and waxed them both, the cameraman and the anchor lady, both of them in their 20s, both of them engaged to be married. And then it turns out they're saying it was a disgruntled employee who wrote a manifesto accusing these two of mistreating him for racial reasons and whatever. So, and then now they're saying the guy has shot himself. They're not saying if he's dead or not. At least as far as I can tell from the closed captioning and the crawl here on MSNBC is the one I have it on today. Lie to me, Democrats. Anyway, yeah, it was, well, there's a lot of different things to say. I guess the most important thing is to contradict the gun controllers. All up and down my Twitter feed today. Oh, gun control. Oh, we need gun control. If only we had gun control. Well, look at this situation, who this guy is. The guy that apparently there's a very, very good chance, you know, I don't know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, but it's pretty clear who the guy is. He, you know, he tweeted and Facebooked about why he did it. Everybody knows him. The dying cameraman spun and got an image of his face as he was falling down dead of the guilty party here with a gun in his hand. So, pretty clear about that. And who is he? He's a former news guy. He's a Virginia news anchor or journalist of some kind. A law-abiding citizen in every way, as far as anybody knows, leading up to this. So on what basis would you deny him a gun? Unless the answer is it should be illegal for all private citizens to own guns. And if that's your position, go ahead and say it. But then even you can see how stupid you look standing there saying that only criminals who, after all, if they're willing to murder, they're willing to break gun possession laws, and government and black market, you know, arms dealers, back to the criminals again, only they should have guns. That's your position. Law-abiding citizens should not. Doesn't matter if Eazy-E is right, that with a gat, it doesn't matter if you're smaller or bigger. This great equalizer of human beings. All decent, regular people who are not guilty of violent aggression against any of their neighbors, they should be disarmed, helpless, before the stormtroopers of death, a.k.a. your local security force you love so much because it kills black people all day, which makes you feel safe or something, is that it? Oh, thank God they waxed another unarmed guy running away because... what if he was running toward me? Yes, only the stormtroopers of death and the black market gun industry and the violent criminals that they sell guns to, they should all be armed and nobody else. That's what gun controllers think. Or what? Less guns. Well, there should be less guns. Really? It should be harder to get one. Again, this guy... is a pillar of his community up until 6:45 Eastern time this morning. So, you know, it's just like Tom Wood's great interview with Stephen Walt yesterday. Tom was going to put me out of business on this show doing foreign policy, man. His interview with Stephen Walt on the Iran deal is better than any of them I've done. It was great. And the first question was, what do you mean by magical thinking? And Stephen Walt said, well, magical thinking is when people don't really have to explain how their idea is supposed to work or why we should believe that it will. Things like, well, we should just have a better Iran deal. Oh, well, we should, huh? Well, let's talk about that. What better Iran deal? And how are you going to make them sign on to it? And what do you even mean by that? And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Magical thinking. Yeah, what we're going to do. We're going to do the thing that we want to do, and then the results are going to be exactly the ones that we say they're going to be. Magical thinking. There's no better example than support for gun control in this country. Magical thinking. First, we ban guns. Question mark, question mark, question mark. And then, profits. Yes, it would require... a civil war that would make Abraham Lincoln's look like nothing, look like a glitch. Yes, there are 150 million civilian gun owners in America right now. 150 million of them. All of whom have the right to bear arms, whether the government abides by its charter or not. And a good portion of them who are willing to fight about it if it comes to, you know, any kind of mass roundup of guns. You try to do like in Australia where you just say everybody turn in your guns. There's going to be a war. There will be a war. And it won't just be right-wingers either. I'm from Austin, Texas, where patchouli stinking, tie-dye wearing, flip-flops and sandals and a joint hanging out of their mouth, hippies with hairs down to their ass, are armed with rifles that would make you crap your pants. So, get over it. Stop with the magical thinking and get real. You don't have to be in favor of gun crime to be in favor of gun rights. Okay, back in a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all.
And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, guys, welcome back. Sorry again about the bulldozer noise in the background. I hope it's not too loud or too distracting. I can tell by the green bars on the recorder that it's getting picked up there, but what do you say, guys? Is it too bad? And it's being kind of quiet right now. Anyway. Hey, listen, so somebody was asking about the Iran deal again this morning. Let's see if I can try to wrap this up for you real quick so that people understand, because there's so much propaganda going around. And people are just depressingly willing to buy into it. But basically, here's the deal. We've had a nuclear deal with Iran since the 1960s. It's called the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, and they're members of it. And back when their government was a wholly owned subsidiary of our government in the 1950s through 70s, we participated in their nuclear program and helped them build it up in the name of Atoms for Peace. Their medical isotope reactor in Tehran was built in the Gerald Ford administration by American corporations. And the way the Non-Proliferation Treaty works is if you're a non-nuclear weapons state like Iran, then your signature means you promise to never get nukes, never to make them and never to buy them or smuggle them or hook or crook. You promise not to. And in order to guarantee that, you are obligated as a non-nuclear weapon state to sign a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which allows them the authority to inspect your declared nuclear sites, wherever nuclear material is being actually introduced into any machinery and used. And the Iranians have had their safeguards agreement with the IAEA all along, before the revolution and ever since, and they are not in violation of it. They never had a nuclear weapons program. The worst accusations are that they did some research into nuclear weapons back before 2003, which is now a dozen years ago. And mostly that's all a bunch of unproven assertions anyway. But the CIA and all 16 or 17 or however many American intelligence agencies agreed that they halted all nuclear weapons research work back in 2003, and they have not made a political decision to begin to make nukes. In fact, they've made a political decision not to stop at this threshold with their civilian nuclear program. The Mossad agrees. Read it in Haaretz. Israeli intelligence agrees with the United States CIA in the Bush years, ever since 2007, and all the way through today, reaffirmed repeatedly, the Iranians aren't making nukes. And they have not made the decision to begin trying to make nukes. And the last research that they did, in even the accusation, was a dozen years ago. So now what is this deal then? Well, the deal is that Israel keeps threatening to bomb Iran and their civilian nuclear program, because they consider any nuclear program in Iran to be tantamount to a ready-made nuclear weapon. And so the Americans have basically, at Israeli behest, have led the world and twisted plenty of arms to do it, to get the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese to go along with these sanctions under the excuse that the only way to keep Israel from bombing them is to put on such sanctions that they're forced to capitulate, at least to great degrees, and scale back their nuclear program to Western liking. And that's what they've done. And that's what the deal achieved. And honest wonks have repeatedly said that they're surprised how much the Iranians are giving up in the deal. And here's what they're giving up. Their Iraq reactor will go from a heavy water reactor that produces plutonium as waste, which they still don't have the reprocessing facility anyway, but they're going to go ahead and make it a light water reactor so that its waste is so polluted with other isotopes it could never be used for a plutonium nuke. They're closing down the Fordo facility, or turning it into a research facility only, with no spinning centrifuges. At Natanz, they're going from 19,000 centrifuges to 6,000, or almost 6,000 centrifuges. And they're scaling back their stockpile of enriched uranium from, I forgot how much it was, 1,500 tons or something. It's a huge amount. They're going to go ahead and burn it all and use it all and keep only the most minuscule stockpile, so that you don't even have the excuse that they have a pile of uranium low enriched that could be enriched up to weapons grade. No, they won't. You'll have to go back to, you know, claiming that their uranium in the ground amounts to a breakout capability when it hasn't even been, you know, refined, converted to gas, and enriched at all. And they're adopting the additional protocol, their safeguards agreement, and plus additional what are called subsidiary arrangements that allow the IAEA to expand their inspections that, again, they've had all along. But now the IAEA is going to inspect their mines, is going to inspect their centrifuge facilities, and every step of the way, womb to tomb. I mean, the typical safeguards agreement doesn't cover mines, but now this additional protocol will, and the additional protocol is forever. And despite the propaganda that you might have picked up from the headlines about 24-day delays on inspections, that's only for so-called suspected sites, military sites that are not nuclear sites. And I'll get back to that in a second, but to the point, all of their nuclear sites will be expanded 24 hours a day permanently. The Bushehr reactor, the Iraq reactor, COM, Fordo, the centrifuge facility, the mines, the conversion facility at Isfahan, all of this will be permanently and totally and absolutely inspected beyond any nuclear program in world history. When they talk about delay on inspections, that's up to 24 days if Iran invokes every timeout they have to try to delay it, which would not be in the spirit of the deal at all and would lead to a major crisis and possibly a snapback in the sanctions immediately if they were to try to give us a hard time about inspecting something like Parchin anyway. But what the deal calls for actually is 24 hours. Show right up and walk right in. And if they were ever doing nuclear implosion experiments at Parchin, you could come back in 100 years and there's still going to be evidence there. Doesn't matter. You're not going to ever be able to wash away uranium. Radioactive particles. Give me a break. But they make it sound like all the inspections are basically everybody, the Iranians get a month heads up anytime the IAEA wants to inspect something, which is just a damn lie by implication. It's one of those excluded middle things where you think that's what they're saying, and so you just go with that. They're not exactly saying all inspections are on this delay, but they just neglect to mention the fact that every bit of their nuclear infrastructure will be inspected permanently. And then all they're getting instead on this side is sanctions relief. They're not getting an American welfare check. They're not getting American taxpayer dollars. They are not getting American money. They're getting their own money back that the U.S. government stole from them. Full stop. Anybody who says otherwise is just, that's a tell, like a twitch on their face, that they don't know what the F they're talking about. Oh, yeah, well, I heard somewhere some crank on Newsmax said so or something. But they actually don't know that because it's not true.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back.
It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is our good friend Sheldon Richman. He is the chairman of the Center for a Stateless Society. Welcome back to the show. Sheldon, how are you, man?
I'm doing fine. Great to be back with you, Scott.
Good, good. Very happy to have you, here. Sorry now about the noise. There's a bulldozer grading the yard next door, and so I'll try to keep my mic off for most of this interview if possible. Hopefully it's not too disruptive. It's actually kind of running quiet right now. But so check this out, Sheldon. I was reading Lou Rockwell's blog, and my favorite conspiracy theorist on the planet, actually, is Charles Burris. And I shouldn't even call him that because that, you know, it sounds like I mean it in a negative connotation kind of a way, but I definitely don't. And I really like, power elite analysis, as he calls it. I'm really interested in this kind of thing. Always have been. That's how I became a libertarian in the first place, actually. I was more of a kook first. I mean that in a nice way. I don't like, you know, reading kooky analysis of what are generally considered kooky subjects, you know, and whatever. So Charles Burris I like because he's very serious and he's a real historian and he's like a walking bibliography, basically, of really great sources and stuff. And so he wrote this thing this short blog entry about libertarian class analysis, and says this is where we separate the men from the boys when it comes to who's really a libertarian and who's not. Is who understands this. And then, of course, the first thing he links to is Libertarian Class Analysis by you, Sheldon Richman. Yeah. So, Sheldon, tell me, why is it that you're not a communist with all your talk about class this and class that, you commie?
Yeah, well, Marx actually could give you an answer to that. As I say in that article right at the top, when you say class analysis or class conflict, most people immediately will think of Marx. And that's been one reason why people who don't like Marx shy away from any talk or thinking about class analysis, because they associate it with Marx. But Marx himself never claimed to invent it, to have invented it. He credited the early 19th century French historians, liberal historians, for first devising class analysis.
Now, and when you say liberal there, you don't mean Marxist, you mean... What exactly?
I mean radical liberal. I mean what we call libertarian. These were complete laissez-faire people. They were historians with a very strong interest in economics, and then of course they associated with economists like Jean-Baptiste Say, and they were fans of Adam Smith. So they were economists in one way, but formerly historians. And they were what we call radical liberals or libertarians. They were for almost all of them, except one exception, was for a very, very limited state, limited government. The exception, who I'm a huge fan of, was Gustave Molinari, who was the first to propose that all the so-called legitimate functions of government could be handled on the marketplace. He's a bit later, anyway, he's kind of in that general category. But getting back to the class analysis, these guys originated the theory that the state itself sets up irreconcilable classes between those who produce wealth and those who expropriate it and give it to their friends. The great English liberal John Bright, a peace activist, free trade activist, along with Richard Cobden. You know, he beautifully described the two groups as the taxpayers and the tax eaters, right, or the tax consumers. And that's the broadest way to approach classes. And it's totally a function of the state, because if the state is taking wealth from people who produce it and giving it out to other people or keeping it for themselves. Of course, they always have to, they always skim off quite a bit before they hand it out to anybody. Then you have, now you have two antagonistic classes, because typically when people produce wealth, they want to keep it. They have their own purposes in mind. They want to make their lives better. They want to, you know, make their families' lives better. And they don't really appreciate when someone comes along and takes it from them, even if they're assured that it's being taken for their own good, which of course is the propaganda and the ideological element there to get people to comply with the tax man. It's, you know, it's cheaper for the tax man if the taxpayers aren't fighting them. So you got to come up with a theory that, no, this is really good for you, that we're taking it away from you. We're doing good things with it, better things than you would do with it. This also relates to another point that libertarian types have made over the years, most explicitly with Franz Oppenheimer in Germany, who pointed out that in his book, The State, that, you know, there's really two ways to acquire wealth. There's what he called the economic means, and that's what the common sense meaning, simply, you know, labor. And the political means, which is the expropriation of the products of other people's labor. There's really, when you come right down to it, those are the only two ways to acquire wealth. You can create it or you can steal it. The state is, and as he puts it, the state is the machinery of the political means. It's the machinery of exploitation. And this has nothing to do with Marx. See, Marx is confused. In some places, he parallels the libertarian class analysis fairly closely, but at other times he messes it up, and he puts the what we call the entrepreneur, let's say, sometimes called the capitalist. There's reasons to be dubious about that word, but the enterpriser, the person that organizes a firm, let's say, the liberals put those types of people in the laboring classes, in what they call the industrious classes. They worked too. They thought, they had to think, they had to come up with ideas, they bore risk, they put together an organization. Assuming they have no links to the state now, and they're doing this just on the basis of voluntary exchange, they are also, in the industrial class. They are the exploited. Marx, you know, made the mistake of putting those people in the exploiter class. You might forgive him for this on the ground, because throughout so much of history, the employer class was linked to the state and did get its wealth through exploitation. And so, you know, maybe it was an honest mistake. Maybe we can forgive him, but we should correct it. An honest entrepreneur who is not getting subsidies, is not getting tax money, he's not taking land by eminent domain the way Donald Trump loves to do. That person is as much a worker as, you know, somebody on the shop floor, or the artisan, or somebody who's, you know, creating something with his hands. Thomas Hodgkin, an early 19th century English radical libertarian, you know, made it a point of saying that mental work is also work, and that therefore the person that thinks up an idea and then organizes an enterprise to get that idea out to the marketplace in the form of goods and services, that person is a worker too, and is not part of the exploiting class if he's not, you know, getting subsidies and other government privileges.
All right. Now, you say here that Marx's confusion stemmed from his labor theory of value. Can you explain how?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story. It's complicated. I won't even claim I'm a master of it. I mean, Marx had this idea that value in the sense of exchange value. Now, back in those days, they talked about value in two terms, use value, which we call utility today, and exchange value, which is price, basically price. So Marx had this idea that, if there's no exploitation going on, the price of something should reflect the labor cost, or what he called the socially necessary labor cost that it takes to make the thing. The Austrian school and others who embrace the subjective theory of value would say the price is determined by people's assessment of the goods, but then as the productive process goes on, competition, assuming there's no balks to competition will drive down price, you know, toward cost, but not just the cost of labor, you know, what it costs to hire somebody to make the good, but also land costs and costs of machines, or maybe renting machines or things like that. So costs are certainly relevant to the formation of prices. But Marx wanted to, boil it all down to one thing,
All right. Well, hold it right there. We'll come back and pick it up with Karl Marx and libertarian class theory right after this with Sheldon Richmond.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Talking with Sheldon Richmond about this article he once wrote for the FFF years ago about libertarian class analysis. He says it was the libertarians who invented class analysis in the first place, and Karl Marx came and screwed it up. Maybe even meant well, but was just confused at the time. But boy, is it a big deal, his error, and the consequences of his error, you know, they're flowing from there. Just, well, we'll get to that in a second. But anyway, you were explaining there, Sheldon, at the break, how it was that he made the error from the idea of the labor theory of value, that the value of something comes from how hard somebody worked to create it, not how much somebody wants it. And so once he made that mistake, then he decided anybody employing anyone else is basically enslaving them and ruining them. And so I guess we all ought to just be employees of the government and then we'll all be free. Something like that.
Yeah, roughly something like that. So his view that all value, not use value now, but exchange value, comes from labor leads to the idea that if the worker is working for someone else and doesn't get the full amount that the product brings in the market, then he's been exploited. This was shown to be incorrect by the second generation Austrian economist, one of the giants, person who actually was an Austrian, Eugen von Bumbaverk.
Sheldon, your Skype's going all screwy on us now. Rewind just a little bit before you talked about Eugen.
Okay, I haven't moved, so I'm in the same position. Must be the CIA or NSA. So Eugen von Bumbaverk, a colorful name, famously showed, at least I believe, and a lot of other people believe, that Marx made a big mistake in claiming that the mere fact, Bumbaverk wasn't bringing politics into this. He was assuming a free market. The mere fact that someone who's working for someone else is not paid the full amount that the product brings in the market is not proof of exploitation. Because it takes time for a good to be produced and eventually sold, but the worker himself doesn't want to wait all that time, right? He wants to be paid every week, every 2 weeks, every month, whatever the case may be. But if you're making a car, you're making a building that takes a long time to build and isn't going to be sold, is not going to yield income for a long time. The worker doesn't want to wait. And so therefore he's advanced wages by the employer. Some of that, in a way, that's a loan, right? Because he's being saved, the worker's being saved the time, the waiting time. And so when the employer eventually sells the product, if he's been right about consumer demand, the proceeds from the sale are going to be greater than what he's paid, in wages. And, you know, a component of that is what we call the entrepreneur's profit, or the pure entrepreneurial profit. Now, when I say this, I'm assuming there's no state intervention whatsoever, because state intervention in the form of corporatism or favors to the employer class, as we have today, could exaggerate that it's sort of implicit interest payment and actually create exploitation of people who work for other people. That's a long story, and it's a bit of a side, would take us far afield. But Bumbaverk, at least in general theory, showed that the mere employment relationship is not inherently exploitative.
Yeah. Well, and in Marx's confusion, what he ended up doing was basically claiming that all entrepreneurship is illegitimate and that you got to live in a totalitarian state instead of allowing people to go into their own businesses.
Well, to be fair to Marx, he did envision the eventual withering away of the state. Although his contemporaries didn't believe him, obviously there were anarcho-communists like Bakunin and others who said, "Yeah, right, fat chance that the state's going to wither away, Karl. Once we get the dictatorship, that's it. That's the end of the story." But Marx, I guess, wasn't convinced.
Yeah, and I guess for the communist anarchists, they're basically totalitarians anyway. I mean, I admit I never read all of Bakunin, but it doesn't make any sense that you're going to have collectivist anarchism and that it's not, that it doesn't just really mean communism in practice anyway. You have your syndicalist board of voters and whatever, deciders. Sounds like communism.
Depends on who we're talking about. I mean, Bakunin seemed pretty serious that he did not like authority in the sense of political authority. He seemed to dislike it as much as Benjamin Tucker disliked it, who was one of the great American individualist anarchists and free market anarchists. I'd be a little careful about thinking that if push comes to shove, they would side with the state. I'm not an expert on Bakunin, but I wouldn't jump to that conclusion.
All right. Well, fair enough. So, but now what's all this got to do with you and me now in 2015 anyway?
Well, what it has to do, here's what it has to do with us. The people who run the government and their, cronies, it's the popular word these days, crony capitalism, and the cronies who are outside the government but have a lot to say about it, use the state to transfer wealth from the great bulk of the population to themselves. I mean, we see this with the war complex, the military-industrial complex, all the time. I mean, trillions of dollars. I mean, even if we just go back to 2001, 9/11, great work was done at the Washington Post by, was it Arkin and is it Dana Priest? Trillions of dollars, which has been taken from the taxpayers and transferred to favored companies and consultants and various, operatives and scholars at universities and then of course government personnel themselves is just unbelievable. The Pentagon can't even account for what, hundreds of billions of dollars every once in a while.
Trillions.
But they simply can't. Yeah, trillions of dollars they can't account. It's like in somebody's pocket somewhere. They forgot about it. Then no one knows what happened to the money. We know that Iraq was a major project to funnel wealth into the pockets of favored companies, Halliburton and all the ones that went over there to build installations and to provide food and of course the name that comes to mind, probably your mind too right now, is Nick Turse, right, who wrote a book on the complex. It's just unbelievable how companies decided, wait a second, why should we make stuff for consumers? We could be making stuff for the state.
You know what, though? Let me play commie for a minute, or, progressive type liberal leftist, some kind of left wing something, and say, yeah, but what you're describing still fits perfect with what Marx said about class. This is the ruling class, evil capitalists, and the empire at war. And what you're doing is you're trying to lump in poor welfare recipients with them and say that, well, they're all the same because they're all using the political means to get by instead of having a job.
Well, what I say to that is I think you can make a distinction between welfare recipients, people at the bottom who are getting food stamps or, ADC payments or things like that from this other group we're talking about. First of all, those people have no clout whatsoever. This idea, and I think here's even some libertarians made a mistake, I mean, going back to Bastiat, they thought that once democracy came in, it was going to change and that everybody now would be, Bastiat has the famous quote of the state is that great fiction by which everybody lives can live at the expense of everybody else. But the reason I think that's not entirely, literally true is that some people have better access, easier access to power than other people. Food stamp recipients don't have access to political power. There, it's true, they're getting tax money. But the reason it's different is the government is throwing them some crumbs to keep them quiet because they may catch on that the system is corrupt and exploitative, and they may decide they don't want to take it anymore. So you give them something to keep you know, put some kind of net under them so things can't get, you know, bad beyond a certain point, because otherwise people may entertain revolutionary thoughts. That's very different from giving money to Lockheed and, you know, these big companies, Boeing, all, you know, all these companies that rake in hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars from the taxpayers, you know, every year, making goods that nobody would be buying in the marketplace.
Yeah.
If the government were not there as the buyer.
You know what, Sheldon, I've been too involved in libertarianism for too long, and I guess maybe you have too, but back when you were already a great libertarian and I was just a kid, I remember hearing Ross Perot talk about the special interest. Special interest this, special interest that. Well, what the hell's that anyway? And I guess the libertarian lesson that I finally learned was the special interests, it is virtually everybody. Or like you said, you could exclude the very, you know, most powerless. But otherwise, the special interests are, you know, the most powerful factions. They're pretty really, you know, easy to name. Bankers and arms dealers and oil salesmen and the medical industries and agribusiness and Israel. And, you know, I guess the old people lobby is just a kind of adjunct of the medical lobby, that kind of thing. But, you know, I guess maybe this isn't fair. I don't mean to sound like patronizing or evil or whatever, but I basically imagine that most Americans are about as lost as I was at 14 listening to Ross Perot talk about special interests and know that he's right, but not know what he means, and certainly not understand that that's what the Constitution is. Regulatory capture from day one. That's what it's for, you know, and just power factions meeting together, the Congress as the Skull and Bones conspiracy meeting house where they come together to plan to rob us. That this is our enemy, the state and the people who exploit it. It's just, it doesn't seem like it's ever made clear in those kind of terms to the people at large. But what do you think?
Yeah, it's pretty open. I don't think you really need to discuss it in conspiratorial terms. It's
well,
not
that's why I say
secret.
The Congress now, is the conspiracy. It's right there on C-SPAN. I mean, you can watch them.
Right. What,
that's which, the what, plot. It's as open as can be.
What it's there for anybody to see, but unless you get seduced by the ideology. The ideology says it's all for our own good. You know, Lysander Spooner, who was, of course, one of the great American libertarians, anarchist, who totally understood the class theory, said, you know, the difference between the government and the highwaymen. You know, the highwayman robs you, right? You're riding down the road and he holds you up and then he leaves you. Unlike the state, he doesn't keep hounding you to convince you this is all for your own good, right? He lets you go once he takes your money. The state is worse because the state spends, you know, a lot of resources convincing you that this is all for your good. And you should love the state for this. And you should every 4 years or 2 years go to the polling place and pick your robber. Because this is all for your own good. So if people buy that, then, you know, they won't object. I think a lot mm-hmm. of people understand it's a scam. They just feel powerless to do anything about it. What worries me today is the people, some of those people who feel powerless to do anything about it are now attracted to Donald Trump, thinking he'll do something about it, but they're not listening to what he says. He doesn't want to reduce government power. Has he said a single thing indicating he would reduce government power? No, quite the opposite. He's going to concentrate power in himself and cut deals. He's going to cut smart deals all over the place. Deals for who? For us. In other words, I'm not going to get to make my own deal with a Japanese car seller. He's going to make the deal for me. He's going to make sure if I buy a Ford that's made in Mexico, I got to pay 35% more for it than I would have if he just butted out.
Well, you know, I was just reading a thing recently that your article reminded me of where I forget some important, you know, modern liberal thinker, and I mean liberal in the modern sense, you know, Democrat type, was arguing that, you know, come on, really, natural liberty and all that is just bogus, and real liberty means participation in democracy. That's as much liberty as you're going to get is you could run for office too, and that's pretty good. So in other words, liberty means exercising power over someone else or you know, having a say in the compromise that leads to the power being exercised over you. But that the idea of just being left alone is just passé at this point. But what's funny is the way you put it in your article is his view is the ancient one that, you know, the American idea supposedly was based on its refutation. and the idea of the natural rights of man to do what he pleased without being aggressed against, except, you know, as the way we learn it in school as kids, unless you commit a crime or violate somebody else.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to another one of those great French thinkers, Benjamin Constant. The last name looks like the word constant. He has a famous essay, you can find it online, called the Liberty of the Ancients Compared to the Liberty of the Modern, something like that. And he points out that the ancient view, going back to, say, Greece, the city-states, the democracies in Greece, freedom really consisted of one thing, and that was the ability to participate in the political process, have your say, cast your vote, and then you had to go along with, you know, whatever the majority decided. The modern notion is the ability to live the private life without your neighbors or anybody else, coercing you, aggressing against you, telling what you have to do with your life, your body, your property. So anybody who takes this view that you're expressing now is a throwback, has this ancient mentality. They like to think they're progressive. It's the opposite of progressive. It's about as regressive and reactionary as you can get. The modern notion of freedom is the idea that you own yourself and other people own themselves. And that sets up the boundaries around people, right? I own me, you own you. So therefore I can't act like I own you. And it's not just no tread on me, it's don't tread on them. Don't tread on anybody.
Right.
That's something people need to understand, and unfortunately they don't.
All right. Well, you know, the one thing that we have going for us, I think, as libertarians, and I don't mean like invoking founding fathers, you know, who were not necessarily heroes and this kind of thing, but, you know, our very bottom line sentiment is the creed of this land. You know, that is the deal. Self-evident truth that everybody's born free, and everybody except, you know, the professors pretty much at least pretends to believe in that. As a starting premise, they don't have the consistency that we have, but they right. do already. We were all raised up on that as our kind of basic belief system. They just, you know, people just need more Sheldon Richmond's to follow the example of, you know, how that natural rights theory can, you know, really express itself, you know, through the rest of these, you know, in answering the rest of these questions. And they don't get enough of that, but so that's yeah. why I think there's well, hope for us yet, you know?
Must well, be. I sort of agree with you, and I did an article some time ago saying that, you know, people are sort of roughly, most people are roughly half libertarian. It's just that they have a double standard, right? They wouldn't go out and rob from their neighbor, even if they plan to do something good with it, right? To give it to the homeless person,
right?
Give the money to the homeless person down the street. They wouldn't think that's right. The neighbor certainly wouldn't think it's right. However, if a politician does it, or if somebody who's been empowered by Congress does it, we have a double standard. We think, oh, that's different. The state can do that. So what we're halfway there, I think. I mean, maybe I'm being over-optimistic.
Yeah.
All we need to do is convince people that there's only one moral standard for all people. By the way, that includes the people of Israel, too. There's only one moral standard for all people. And if stealing is wrong, and it is wrong, then political stealing is also wrong. The fact that you put political in front of the word, you know, doesn't make it right. Bastiat used to talk about legal plunder. It's still plunder.
Right.
Even if 50% plus one say, yeah, let's rob the other 49, we're not supposed to be moral relativists. That's wrong, no matter how many people endorse it.
All right, y'all, that's Sheldon Richmond. Find him at SheldonRichmond.com and find this one at FFF.org, Libertarian Class Analysis. Thank you so much, Sheldon.
Anytime, Scott. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Wasn't that great? You guys like it? Chat room guys, you like it?
Yeah, there's the chat room. ScottHorton.org/chat. Yeah, I kept interviewing Sheldon all through the top of the hour break there, man. I cut him off just right before that thing started playing. That's cool, huh? Our good friend Jeremy did that. He did the one at the top of the first hour as well, the one that's been there for a little while. Now we've got the second one. Bad Brains in the background. All three Bushes talking about wars. Obama bombing Libya and some George Carlin and hell yes. It was perfect. And so, yeah, we got more too, man. I sent him a bunch of clips. And we've kind of been going back and forth about what kind of music to use in the background and stuff. I think I like keeping it hardcore, you know, Poison Idea and Bad Brains. And maybe we get, there are a couple different Public Enemy beats that I think might be good. But I'm not much of a musician, you know, I gotta leave a lot of the deciding to him, but, those things, they're just great, man. Wouldn't it be cool if we had, like, a lot of them in rotation? And you know what else that means, guys, chat room guys? No more Onion Radio news at the top of the second hour. It's gone forever. Now, I think we'll probably still hear some Onion in rotation during the rest of the commercial breaks. But we will no longer have it at the top of the second hour or the first. Which is just great because the Onion sucks now. You know, there was a time, I remember one time spending like 4 hours, five hours maybe on a Sunday morning, like an entire Sunday morning watching Onion clips of their fake news. And some of that stuff was just so great, but even the stuff that's great, once you heard it 16 times or 160 or 1600, then yeah, pretty much over that now. So anyway, man, that's really cool. Thank you to Ian for getting that set up for me. And, you know, I also sent him a bunch of more bumper musics. Well, let's see, a couple dozen more bumper musics. Some of them are old bumper musics I want back in rotation. Some of them are new ones, but not very many. If you have good ideas for 30 seconds worth of music, favorite songs you think might fit that you'd like to suggest, let me know. I'm an old man now. I just got the same old stuff. You've heard it. Beastie's, Public Enemy, Poison Idea. That's my entire collection of music, okay? And some Black Sabbath and a couple other things, but that's about it. So, I need to diversify, I know. I'm just busy. All right, so, yeah, listen, let me say more Iran things, because before when I was doing my Iran bit, I got interrupted by the break. So, where we left off, I was explaining that the money that the Iranians are getting is not a bribe. It's not America on its knees paying Iran to please do what we say or please stop doing the thing that you're pretending to be afraid of or whatever it is. It's their money that America stole, all right? So when somebody tells you, oh, yeah, we're giving them this giant welfare check, they're wrong or they're lying. You choose, depending on the circumstances. All right. And then the other thing is the re-rise of the Persian Empire and how America now is bankrolling it and or allowing it by lifting the sanctions. They're going to have all this money and they're going to conquer the whole Middle East. Well, America conquered half of Iraq for them. In the Iran-Iraq War, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush took the side of Saddam in containing the Iranian Revolution and keeping it out of southern Iraq and keeping the southern Iraqi Shia down. Then, come 2003, George W. Bush, because he's a stupid idiot, invaded Iraq and got rid of Saddam for Iran, and they won the Iran-Iraq War without firing a shot. The Badr Brigade and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah Party came across the border. Hey, Landay said on this show, Jonathan Landay of McClatchy, then Knight Ritter, said on this show, hey, I was standing there when Abdulaziz al-Hakim came across from Iran into Kurdistan and said, you know, show me to my kingdom. He was there. And so George W. Bush won
the Iran-Iraq War for Iran in 2003. And then all those times that you were chanting, but we have to stay. We can't cut and run or else the violence will get worse. We have to stay. We have to stay. You were using the U.S. Army and Marine Corps as auxiliaries of the Iranian-backed militias, primarily the Badr Brigade of the Supreme Islamic Council, in fighting their sectarian war against the Sunni Arabs, kicking them out of the capital city, and setting up the chain of consequences that's playing out to this day. And, yeah, it's true that local Sunnis had turned on al-Qaeda in Iraq and marginalized them until Obama took the side of al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria, starting in 2011. And that was al-Qaeda in Iraq still existed in Iraq, and they still were attacking the Shiite government in Baghdad, doing suicide attacks and all kinds of things all along. But, if George W. Bush, took them from, 0 to 10 on the scale by, when he turned over eastern Iraq to Iran, he pushed all the Sunnis into al-Qaeda in Iraq's arms in the West. And so if he took them from 1 to 10 there, Obama took them up to 20 or 25 by carving out the space for them to fight in Syria, which led to the rise of the Islamic State. So that's what Iran is doing in Iraq right now. It's kind of their fault. It's America's fault and their fault for being so partisan and so sectarian and driving the Sunni Arabs of Iraq into the arms of al-Qaeda, now the Islamic State. But now who's fighting the Islamic State? Iran. Oh, no. Iran is going to use their weapons to kill people in the Middle East. Who? The Islamic State. Right now, the Iranians are helping the so-called Iraqi army that the USA put in power there and built. The Dawa Party, again, America and Iran's puppets there, the Iranians are helping them lay siege to the Islamic State in Fallujah and Ramadi right now. They're deadly enemies, despite what you might have learned from the Republicans about radical Islam. There's actually a massive sectarian war between the Sunni and Shia now. The Iranians are the capital of Shiistan. You know? They rule Shiistan. But then their support for Assad, if anything, he controls less territory than ever before. So they've always had an alliance with him. And yeah, they're supporting him in his war against who? The Islamic State and al-Qaeda. Assad and Iran. Assad, the Ba'athist Alawite dictator of Syria, with Iran's help, is fighting against al-Qaeda. That's, the horror of spreading Iranian power around the Middle East. They're trying to defend the last Shia left alive in Syria from the head chopper suicide bomber enemies of America, who America's government supports. I mean, America, the country, the enemies of America, the country, the people, allies, again, with the government of the USA there. At least to a degree, gotta admit, at least, one step indirectly. If that's enough to satisfy you for plausible deniability, it's not for me. It's implausible deniability is all it is to me. Helping the Saudis and the Turks and the Qataris back al-Qaeda for 5 years in a row, that's not an accident. Doing nothing to stop them. Come on. And then they support Hezbollah. Well, what's Hezbollah doing? They're fighting al-Qaeda, trying to keep al-Qaeda out of Lebanon. That's what Hezbollah's busy doing right now. Israel cries all day about how afraid of Hezbollah they are, but then what are they doing other than giving them a bunch of battlefield experience fighting terrorists, fighting bin Ladenites? So there's another myth. They haven't invaded any of these countries. The biggest move they've made in the Middle East this whole time is America's move into Iraq for them. More debunkings. Police state news and more after this. Oh, I'm going to accuse Joe Biden of things, too. You'll like it.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire.
It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. Let me just wrap up here real quick about Iran. There's a great, I mentioned this at the beginning, I'll say it again. Tom Woods did a great interview with Stephen Walt from Harvard, author of The Israel Lobby and American Foreign Policy, and you should listen to it. It's about Walt's. Walt's piece, The Myth of the Better Deal, something like that. And anyway, again, you know, this is one, and I think Tom Woods makes the great point where, you know, Walt is talking about magical thinking, and Tom Woods says, no, I think they're lying. I think they're disingenuous, and what they want is a war, and they're trying to stop the peace. They're trying to prevent this deal because it'll make it too hard for them to have a war. And Walt says, well, yeah. Pretty much. But so, just like with any of these wars, you have to take the real reasons and debunk those, and then, but you have to take all the fake reasons that they invoke and debunk those too, and, you know, it wastes a lot of time, but you gotta do what you gotta do. And so, here, there is no better deal. There is no better deal. The Iranians, and their population agrees. Their population is 100% behind their government on the position that they will never give up their entire nuclear program. It's a matter of independence. What if the UN and the rest of the world told America that we had to give up our nuclear program, even our civilian nuclear power, because they said so? Right, we would shoot nuclear weapons at them and kill them all, probably. And say, oh yeah, how do you like that? Okay, same kind of principle here, only for them, it's just, we're going to hold on to our last few centrifuges and screw you, man. That's it. That's their position. They're not ever going to give up all of it. And Stephen Walt, in that Tom Woods interview, makes the great point that if you got the perfect deal from the American point of view, that's, and actually Tom made the point first, any kind of negotiation has to be a compromise, otherwise you're not going to get the deal anyway. Or, and then Walt says, let's say America just absolutely held a H-bomb to their head or some kind of thing, found a way to force them to capitulate to 100% of what America wants. Well, then all we've done then is given them an incentive to try to break out of the deal, to try to scotch the deal for the next president to come in, the next Iranian president to come in and say, we're not going to abide by this anymore. What you want to do as a smart diplomat is do a deal that gives the Iranians enough incentive, at least, to want to stay in the deal. To prefer no nuclear weapons program and no sanctions to a nuclear weapons program and sanctions and maybe war. Keep them within the deal. Make the deal good enough for them that they'll want to do it. Otherwise, you're blowing it. Otherwise, you might get what you want now, but it's not going to last. And for, and I'm sorry to even bring up Rand Paul, but he actually is kind of the quintessential example here. He quite disingenuously said that, yeah, we should have a better deal. It leaves too much of Iran's nuclear infrastructure in place. Oh, come on. They went from 20,000 centrifuges down to 5,000 something at Natanz. Closed down Fordo entirely, completely cut off their even theoretical ability to make nukes out of plutonium waste from their reactors by having Americans, not just, European sock puppets of the Americans, but Americans are going to get to redesign and rebuild and reconfigure the Iranian reactor at Iraq. That's not enough. Come on. Should have just held out and been tougher and got a better deal. Like what? There is no better deal. This deal went way further. If you look at all the wonks over at armscontrolwonk.com and at the Carnegie Endowment for being a sometimes warmongering sock puppet of power or whatever, any of these places, you'll see all the wonks, you know, back when they announced the agreed framework, went, wow, they're going to do all that? They're gonna completely stop using any nuclear material at the Fordo facility whatsoever? They're going to expand inspections even to their centrifuge facility where there's no nuclear material whatsoever? 24 hours a day? Wow, John Kerry really got them to capitulate to incredible degrees. Gary Samore, I told you about this. Gary Samore resigned from the Obama administration. Said he could not be a part of these negotiations, went to be the head of United Against a Nuclear Iran, which is funded by Sheldon Adelson, the primary backer of the Likud Party in Israel and the Republican Party in America, and went up there and did everything he could to try to ruin the deal. And then they announced the deal, and he went, wow, you got the Iranians to agree to all that? And this is not some, you know, sock puppet fakery. You can tell if you read his interview at Fox, this is not some like, hey, Gary, pretend to oppose me and then come around and play good cop at the end. This is not one of those, dude. If you read the deal, I mean, if you read the interview, you can tell that he's dead. Man, when the Ayatollah said that I'll be damned if we're going to scale back our centrifuges, I believed him. And then when they announced the deal that, wow, they're going to really scale back their centrifuges, I said, I'm satisfied. I'm sorry, but if this isn't a good deal, there's no such thing as one. And so did United Against a Nuclear Iran say, all right, leader, let's sign on for the deal. This is the best way to prevent a nuclear Iran. No, they fired him and replaced him with Joe Lieberman. John Bezalutli has a great article today at the American Conservative Magazine. American Jews reject the Israel lobby and support the Iran deal. Jewish organizations might, in great measure, not all of them, not exclusively, but in great measure, they may support the Israeli position, but the Jewish population of America does not. They support the deal by a wide margin. And this article is, American Jews reject the Israel lobby and support the Iran deal. The war coalition of billionaires, fundamentalists, meaning born-again Christians, cornerstone church types, and Netanyahu cronies doesn't speak for Jewish opinion. And then Dick Lugar, it's too bad he's not in the Senate now. It's the one thing he's good on is nuclear issues. And only because he kind of took an interest in it as a senator. He didn't really have a background in it. But he helped push the deal to buy up excess Russian nuclear material and that kind of deal. Which there's a welfare program I'll support in the short term until we get to anarcho-capitalism, okay? Buying up excess weapons-grade plutonium floating around the stands of the former USSR. Dick Lugar, so he's come out in favor. And let's see, Republican senator sees momentum for Iran deal. This is Bob Corker. And he's upset because it looks like the Democrats are going to try to filibuster and prevent the Republicans from even passing the no vote in the Senate for Obama to have to override. So that's looking good. I don't much believe in calling your congressman, but call your congressman.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Richard Secord isn't dead? Did you know that? I remember one time fighting with this old man in my cab. He's like, oh yeah, man, the Iran-Contra cocaine dealers or something. And he was like, hey, Richard Secord is a friend of mine. He's a decent man. You don't know nothing about General Secord. And yeah, I know he's a dope pusher.
Well, him and John Poindexter and, I'm not really against dope pushers. I just am anti, you know, the government that makes the market black, then monopolizing it and preying on people. Anyway, these guys, Richard Secord, Jerry Boykin, you know, the guy who says that our war with Islam is, Christian crusaders versus the forces of Satan. Remember him? And, John Poindexter. Also, with Richard Secord of Iran-Contra fame and also the guy who created Total Information Awareness before they renamed it basketball and moved it over to the National Security Agency. But anyway, yeah, you can read all about that in James Bamford's book, The Shadow Factory. And, yeah, well, anyway. So that's kind of funny. Yeah, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, and then this is also funny in Iran news. They made a correction, actually, which they never do. But they made a correction to a David Sanger piece admitting that, in fact, the IAEA has already been to Parchin twice. Not just once. Of course, yeah, we knew that, but anyway. Oh, and then also... the IAEA is now saying that they have received a substantive volume of data from Iran, a collection of documents on activities over the years that they're still reading through. But they have turned over a huge treasure trove of everything nuclear, apparently, to see if they can resolve the last of the bogus possible military dimensions accusations, which is a catch-all which includes the Israeli-forged so-called smoking laptop, but also other accusations as well. So anyway. Ridiculous crap. The Parchin accusations, the Maravan accusations, etc. So we're going to have answers for all that soon enough. All right, so that's enough of the Iran thing. Now, I wanted to point out, did you ever notice just how completely ridiculous and dishonest apologists for the Israeli state are? Invariably. You know, like these Twitter trolls, the Hasbara trolls, who, they ain't following you, they ain't following me, they're just Googling Twitter for keyword Israel, and just trying to find someone to troll over anything. And they never make any sense. So today a guy puts out a story on the Twitter there, which I retweeted, about how the Israelis have been selling weapons down in South Sudan, where there's a civil war going on ever since the CIA broke South Sudan off from regular Sudan, which they had a huge civil war where 5 million people died, almost something like that. And almost all of them in the South, they were the victims, but they had a seat. No, you know what? I got my five in there somewhere wrong. The five, I don't know how my brain just misfired that way, but actually I do know how. It was 1 million dead. It was a 5-year peace before America came and broke the South off. The fighting was over. The South had autonomy. The peace deal was more or less holding. And as soon as America broke the South off from the rest of Sudan, then the two major tribes in the South went to war with each other, the Nuer and the Dinka. And they've been killing each other, and now they're finally trying to get this peace deal going. And we'll see how that works out. Reuters today says South Sudan president to sign peace deal. But anyway, so the report was Yeah, Israel's apparently been selling weapons in that civil war because, hey, money, right? So then the answer, the Hasbara answer to that is, oh, if only there was a Palestinian state, then there wouldn't be a civil war in South Sudan, huh? What? That's really your best pro-Israel argument, pro-Israel people, that you can come up with, huh? That's not what he was saying. He was saying, hey, look, Israeli arms manufacturers are profiting from the horrible civil war in South Sudan. What does that have to do with Palestine at all? Other than the same people making money there are the ones making money occupying them, too. But what the hell kind of ridiculous argument is that? And then and his other great point was about, well, Hamas, a dozen years ago was the last time they did this, as far as I'm aware, suicide bombed civilians in Israel. Yes, that's a fact, and it's horrible. So that supposedly justifies the war last summer, the slaughter of 500 children? Because a decade previous, Hamas had done suicide attacks? That's really your best argument for Israel occupying Palestine and waging, you know, biannual, or no, that's twice a year. What's the one where it's every 2 years? Anyway, every couple of years going in and just doing a canned hunt in Gaza and slaughtering 1,500 people to death or so. And then calling it off and then doing it again. You know, I don't know. I had to consider selling out and seeing if I could get paid a bunch of money, and then I would help these idiot liars with their stupid, horrible public relations failures and see if I can try to come up with a little bit more convincing arguments. Because, you know, it seems to me Hasbara's fallen flat. But, you know, the thing is, my truck is 20 years old, but I really like it. And so, I don't really want the money. But, boy, do you suck, Hasbara trolls. Here's the truth about Israel, everybody, okay? Here's what you need to understand that you may not understand. They won the war in 1967, and they've occupied the Palestinians ever since then. So think of it like this. If the Palestinians had won the war in 1967... which, that wasn't their war. It was the neighboring states who launched the war. It's the Palestinians who got, occupied at the end in the deal. But say it was the other way around. The neighboring states won the war and then built up a big Palestinian government and military to rule over all the Israeli Jews in occupied territory and then herded them into the Gaza Strip ghetto and then laid siege to it. Would that be kosher? And is what's wrong with that just who's who and who's on whose side? Or is it the fact of a foreign military occupying civilians for 50 years? For longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe. The people of Palestine have been occupied by the so-called Israeli Defense Forces and internal police forces. They have no vote. No say in the power that rules their lives. And on top of that, in violation of the international law that America foisted on the world after World War II, they are consistently colonizing the West Bank, of the Jordan River, which they call Judea and Samaria, and claim that magically, according to 2,000-year-old Hebrew mythology, they have superior property rights than the people who live there, who are the sons and grandsons and great-grandsons and daughters of the people who live there, going back 2,000 years. In fact, I read a thing recently where, Jabotinsky or one of the original Zionist leaders argued that the Palestinian Arabs that lived there were real Jews, but had just been forced against their will to convert to Islam. So we can just go and integrate with them because they are the real Jews of Palestine, obviously, or else what are they doing there? That was one of the original Zionist arguments for going. It's not fair. Get it? That's the bottom line. And America pays for it all. Give them independence.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Boy, MSNBC hadn't changed the channel from changed the story from this shooting all day now. And you know what? It's horrible. And okay, it's on video, so good ratings for the still shots or whatever. But come on, man. People get shot a lot. This is the only news in the world right now. It's freaking sad, dude. I don't know. Somebody murdered somebody in my family. I would hope it would not be a circus for the interest of MSNBC and their dish soap sales. You know? But anyway. Did you see this one at Politico.com? How Google could rig the 2016 election. Google has the ability to drive millions of votes to a candidate with no one the wiser. And I really want you to look at this, and especially you computer genius types, tell me what you think of it. So here's the deal, man, about it. I haven't checked their methodology and whatever, but apparently they did a, you know, social science experiment, university style here. And what they did was they made a fake search engine that basically is the exact same thing as Google. And they did it. They tried to do it pretty well. It sounds like the way they describe it. They used, you know, a double blind system where the people administering the experiment don't know what's going on any more than the people who are doing it, or, you know, not too much more than the people who are the subjects of the experiment. They don't know who's who and who's being experimented on, who's the control group and who's not, and this kind of thing. So they did the best they could, in other words, to make this as fair and objective as possible. And they ran the study a bunch of times. And what they found was that, never mind, and you're different, right? Because, you know, if you're a listener to this show, then you got things that you believe that you're pretty attached to. Maybe you're changing them, but you're probably not that easy to manipulate. I'd like to think. You'd like to think. But according to this study, the average Joe, despite what he says he believes, is basically willing, their mind is capable of being manipulated into voting for just whoever Google spits up in the first three results. And it doesn't matter then if one is, teenage, Latina, lesbian, whatever kind of, identity, politics, progressivist. If Google says vote Trump, they vote Trump, or they vote Sanders or whoever, basically based on who's the results. And so they did this over and over again. And basically the point of it is too, is that it's the slightest little tick in the algorithm. It's like we talked about on, Liberty.me last night, Eye on the Empire with Jeff Tucker, where the computer decides, hey man, it's not any person. It wouldn't have to be the leadership of Google. It could be one rogue employee at Google who just makes it where you're going to get Hillary results just a bit more often, and that's enough to give you a huge percentage difference in the results. And they said, and of course, it's a snowball effect type thing, right? They talk about the Indian elections of 2014 and how Modi was getting the good results, and the more good results he got, the more good results he got. Because the more people click on him, the better his results get. The more people click, the better the results. And anyway, it's a level of power. Oh, and they talk about here, in America, Google has a 75% supermajority type monopoly. But there are some countries in the world where it's 90%. where this is like, as they compare it here, this would be almost like if we only had one channel of TV news. Just one. Not that it really makes that much difference, but I guess, it, you know, a bit it does. And that's the whole thing about the internet is it's not supposed to work like that, right? Because you can follow these hyperlinks wherever they go, and you can read whatever you want, and you can be exposed to all kinds of different points of view that you never, you know, even thought you needed to know before, and then find out you did, and cool, and this kind of thing. And yet, you know, it, basically, on the individual level, you could argue it. But on the mass level, it works, man. It just works. It's the same as the consensus about Obama in 08, for example. Something like that. We're just, this is a done deal, everybody, isn't it? And everybody on TV agrees that it is, and so it is. And anyway, you know, I've mentioned from time to time how I took psychology class. I don't have a degree or anything, but I went to junior college for a couple of years here at ACC. And I studied psychology and social psychology basically just to try to protect myself, you know. I wanted to learn, you know, all the ways to manipulate people. And what's funny about it is everybody else in my class was in marketing, right? Like in the, when I, especially when I took social psychology, which was the second semester or whatever. Everybody there was just going into advertising for a living. And how do I make people afraid that if they don't buy my product, then they won't get laid or, you know, whatever it is. And I was the only one there who was there because I hate the government, I hate the media, and I want to prevent myself from being manipulated by people who, you know, I'm not choosing to allow their influence, you know? And so these kinds of things always trip me out, man. The way, you know, how different people take things depending on who's in the room with them when they're doing their learning, you know, or I like to use this one because it's the most insulting, probably. If you show people, doesn't matter what the propaganda is, either it could be John Birch propaganda or it could be environmentalist Earth First propaganda or whatever it is. Sit down a room full of people, show them a video of your political views and say, okay, so who wants to sign up for my newsletter? And you'll get X percent. And then if you feed them jelly beans or popcorn, salty peanuts or something fun like that while they're watching the video, you'll get X times 100, you know, percent, increase. It'll go from, you know, from two or three or, you know, out of a group to the vast majority of the group will sign up for your newsletter if you just, you know, engage their sugar receptors and confuse their visual and auditory and never mind that. Never mind what they're hearing, but their thinker that is supposed to be considering what they're hearing. And deciding what they think of what they're hearing. It all just becomes irrelevant because, look, here's some popcorn. Put this in your mouth and believe me. And it works. It's like magic it works so well. It's terrifying it works so well. You ever watch Penn and Teller, their Showtime show, BS? Did I ever tell you about how I damn near hung myself from the ceiling fan? Hanged, I guess. After watching about six seasons of that in a week. Like, oh my God, the adult Homo sapiens sapien is a tiny little pathetic child. It's absolutely ridiculous. I just, and I like people, man. I'm actually not that bad of a misanthrope, and that's why I had to quit watching that show. I didn't finish. I'm pretty sure they never got around to debunking the Empire, which is shameful. But the things that people are willing to believe, the ease with which people can be manipulated is, it's the kind of stuff that bums me out the most. Kind of stuff that catches my attention the most. You know, how much power and influence does a search engine, does the order of search engine results have on the way you perceive these candidates and what they are likely to do with the power that you would give them? You know, something irrelevant. I like to joke, too, about the thing John Cleese did a special on The Face. You can watch the whole thing. It's really long. And I scanned through it, but I couldn't find the part. It's like four parts long or something. I couldn't find the part to link to, but there's a part of the special on the human face that John Cleese does where he shows that ever since the advent of photography, the American presidential candidate in the general election with the most symmetrical face wins. Because it's a sign of healthy genes and stuff, you know? This is alpha male we're choosing here. And so somebody like Scott Walker, disqualified. It's your crooked-ass chromosomes. Get out of here. Doesn't matter whether he's a fascist or whether he's not, right? He could be the greatest guy in the world. He's not. But he can't win because his face is too damn crooked. These kinds of things, man, are things that... Well, they're entertaining to me in a horrible kind of way, too. But anyway, check it out again. It's at Politico.com. It's well worth your read. Politico magazine is different from Politico. And I've read some real good pieces of journalism in here. Politico.com, how Google could rig the 2016 election. I'm sorry I went on so long because I was going to tell you about 100 cases of police murders lately. Go look at Keegan Steffen on Twitter. He's got a good half dozen for you from just the last couple of days. Thanks, y'all, for listening to me. I'll be back here tomorrow.